fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is...
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live, Owl Radio, and our first show of 2023. We're on the air the second Wednesday of the month, this slot from 6 until 7pm at CKUT 90.3 FM. We wish everyone the best of health and lots of energy for 2023 and the struggle ahead. We're feminist radio from an elderly perspective, pushing that feminist agenda uphill, and it takes everyone and more to push. Today we're going to be talking about housing and the problems faced especially by older women. Let's put aside for a moment the most economically deprived groups in Canada, from Indigenous groups to newly arrived refugees. Women over 75, especially those who never married, are among the poorest people, and their poverty is permanent. Housing is particularly problematic. Most women have lived quietly in the same modest apartment for years. Suddenly, they have to move. Moving is often traumatic. And where do you move to? More and more people, especially elder women, are confronting this catastrophic situation. There are fewer and fewer apartments available, and rents have skyrocketed as the Quebec Rental Board, or TAL, the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, seems to have lost its will to live and receded into oblivion. Money grabbers hog digital platforms to rent and promote Airbnbs, and people from all over the world see Quebec housing as a money-making scheme. The federal government has passed legislation forbidding foreigners from buying property in Canada for the next 2 years. Perhaps too little, too late. Many frail elderly women are having their apartments repossessed and have nowhere to go. There are no groups helping them relocate. In this callous and indifferent society, they must fend for themselves. In the meanwhile, the Government of Canada has just announced that Canada is buying 88 fighter jets from the American armaments company Lockheed Martin. Cost of purchase without any maintenance is $19 billion. $19 billion tax dollars from Canadians. Needless to say, we need our tax dollars to build social housing, daycare centres, schools, to say nothing of our broken healthcare system, and to look after frail elderly people who once looked after us. Earlier today, I sat down with Sue Sokol, one of the workers at Project Genesis, an organisation devoted to housing. Here's our interview. As you're very aware, Sue, more aware maybe than I am, old women and housing is a real crisis, isn't it?
Yes, it's been a very, very big problem for older people in general, and particularly older women. We've seen a lot more people very destabilized by the housing crisis, and the impacts are much harsher now than they have been in the past.
Exactly. I think it's important that we say that older women, especially older women who were never married, are amongst the poorest in our society, and of course extremely vulnerable in every way. So what are some of the issues that you're finding that people are coming to Project Genesis about?
Well, we see a whole gamut of issues. You know, we see a lot of problems with repair issues, landlords not making repairs, landlords not paying attention to problems like noise complaints or other things. And we see landlords trying to get people out, and it's especially people who are older, because people who are older tend to have been living in their apartments for much longer than people who are younger, and for that reason, their rents tend to be lower because of the rules that are in place that have to do with lease renewals and so forth. So an older person living in an apartment is a prime candidate for a landlord who's greedy to try to get them out and then re-rent it to someone who could afford to pay large rents and do renovations and so on and so forth. So they're targeted in various ways to try to get them to leave the building. And in the past, if a landlord was trying to get somebody out, it was always a big problem. But in the past, it was much easier to find another apartment that was affordable, but now that's not really possible. So once you've been evicted, the chances of you finding another place that's affordable are quite small. So we've been seeing a lot of that. I mean, I could talk in more detail about the various ways that I've seen people, you know, victimized by landlords trying to get them out.
Yeah, tell us some.
I mean, like the first thing I mentioned with the repairs, of course, a landlord that's failing to do repairs could be doing that not just because they don't want to spend any money and they don't care, but also as a tool to try to force people to leave because they're so miserable that they can't bear to be in the apartment anymore. No, if it's too cold, especially when you're older, when the apartment isn't sufficiently heated, it's much more difficult. It's people tend to be colder and they tend to get ill as a result of not having sufficient heat in their apartment. Noise complaints, it's another area where older people are particularly vulnerable to loud noises, to having their sleep disrupted. Other things, landlords, that we've seen a big rise over the last few years is on landlords trying to repossess apartments, not in good faith, not because they really want to live there or because a relative really wants to live there, but as a way of getting someone out and not needing to renew their leases. There are two basic ways that a landlord, because in Quebec, you know, tenants have a right to a renewal lease at the end of their term. They have a right to stay. And there are only certain very limited situations where a landlord is allowed to not renew someone's lease. One of them is repossession, where the landlord says, I'm going to live here instead, or mm-hmm. My mother's going to live here instead. The second area is where a landlord says they want to subdivide the apartment or enlarge the apartment or change what they call change its destination, by which they usually mean, let's say, changing it from a residential unit to a commercial unit. And people are trying even to do that to say that they want to do short-term rentals like Airbnbs. And so that's another way that you could, under the color of law, you know, try to get rid of you know, older people who have been in their apartments a long time. And then there's just the landlord who just comes around and says, we're renovating, you have to leave. And tenants often don't know their rights, and they think that means that they have to leave. It's not actually true. Their tenants have a lot of rights in that situation. We call that rent eviction. I think people have been hearing about rent eviction sometimes in the papers. But that's also a very, very common way of getting someone out, saying you have to leave because I'm renovating. And if the person even knows their rights and says, no, I'm not leaving and you need to do this legally, but if they've eliminated most of the people in the building and now you're the only one left and there's construction going on all around you, you know, it becomes unbearable. It becomes an unbearable living situation. And so that's another way of getting people out. And it has particularly harsh impact on older tenants. For obvious reasons and for the reasons I've discussed.
Yeah, I'm wondering. I mean, it used to be that, you know, you could go to the Régie de Loyer, which, of course, you still can. But it used to be that the Régie really, really functioned. But this was in the early days of the 70s. I mean, it doesn't really function now, does it?
Well, I wasn't here in the early days of the 70s. I'm from New York, where things also are very dysfunctional, but in different ways. But so now the Régie, they call it the Tribunal de Logement. There are different rules, and they've made it much less accessible to the public. You know, the TAL, as we call it, the Tribunal, will tell the public, oh, we're doing great. There are less long waits for tenants to bring cases. Well, that's because no one's bringing cases.
because
there's no way, because they're still closed. You can't even walk into the building and start a case. Like, they're trying to get people to do everything online. And that's another thing that's really difficult for, you know, our older neighbors, is not everyone is that adept with the computer. And it's not simple. It's actually quite complicated to bring a case on the TAL website. And so it makes it even harder for people, or they have to kind of go online and make an appointment in order to start a case. Or they could try to call, but then, like, they're on hold for a very, 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 very long time. So it's almost impossible. It's very difficult. For landlords, it's actually much easier because the process on the website has been simplified, believe it or not. But the kinds of cases that tenants want to bring, it's not been simplified. You have to do a lot more difficult things. You have to, like fill out a paper and then print it and scan it and sign it and reload it. And it's very, very, very complicated. So it's hard for people to use these tools at all. And tenants' cases aren't even prioritized. Like, a non-payment case will always go first before a tenant repair. Like, a tenant could have really harsh, very terrible conditions in their apartment, and still the non-payment case is going to take priority. Because for some reason, the tribunal feels like the landlord being able to collect their rent is more critical than a tenant being able to live, like, in a safe environment in a dignified conditions.
So are there any organisations which are helping these tenants? I mean, it must be a nightmare. I know, as an old person, mm-hmm. what this must mean.
I'm just
thinking of, like you were saying, about the computer, you know. I mean, my heart's in my mouth a lot of times when I have to use the computer.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we take this transport now, we have to go and we have to buy tickets in a display machine, and mm-hmm. you know, people stand there and they kind of look confused. So I'm just wondering if there are any organizations which would help people.
There are. I mean, let me kind of go back to that question a little bit. There are organizations that are trying to help people, but the problem you're talking about is really important, and I think it deserves another, you know, minute, because all of the government organizations are trying to flip over to situations where people need to get their information from a computer. Wow. And when they try to telephone, it's almost impossible to reach people. Now, how does this relate to this issue? It's the same thing for Service Canada. I wanted to just bring this up. A lot of people who are pensioners Sometimes they have had issues where their supplement gets cut, or there's a problem with their pension check, or they've had a change. Like, let's say someone had been working and they've now retired, and so they need to have their pension recalculated because now they're not making the money they had made before. They'll come here and we can help them with the paperwork and it gets sent in, but there might be 8 months delay before the papers are treated, and meanwhile they have to pay their rent. That's how it relates back to the topic, because now we have like 8 months when a person actually may not be able to pay their rent because Service Canada is so slow to process their applications to recalculate their pensions, and then they get into trouble and into eviction situations. And if you try to call Service Canada to expedite it, we've had waits sometimes of an hour and a half, 2 hours, or they won't even put you on hold because there are so many people waiting. And so when you say, are there organizations out there helping people? Well, yeah, but how many people can you help when you have to be on hold for an hour and a half? Think about that. Like, so it limits how many people we can help just because there are only so many hours in a workday. And the same thing for the tribunal, if we try to call them. Same problem. We can't reach anybody. And so, you know, people are out there trying to help, but it's really difficult even for the organizations to help people because of these problems with access or reaching people, and because it's been made so complicated on the computer. Sometimes you can do something for someone on the computer, and sometimes you can't because you're forced to create an account and that doesn't work, or the person, maybe they don't have an email address, and then you're not allowed to access the system because they don't have an email address. So it's quite complicated.
Well, I know our program, Older Women Live, did work with the people in, what was it called? Maison Montcarmel. It was on the Maison Neuf. Do you know that story?
I don't.
Okay, so this is a residential accommodation for old people, for independent old people. And somebody came along and bought this building, a young guy, I think from Israel.
Okay.
For millions of dollars.
Oh, it's starting to sound familiar.
Even though he promised not to throw the people out, of course he did.
Yes.
He tried to throw them out. But they stood their ground and they went to court. Now, I don't know what happened in the end. But they got a lot of publicity. Of course, it was a big apartment.
It was a residence, yes?
It was a residence.
I do remember
this. For independent people.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, there are too many loopholes in the laws that allow people, you know, to get over, really, to evict people, to make the rents unaffordable. We need to close some of those loopholes, and there are organizations out there who are doing this kind of work. You know, like Reclac and Frappou and all the local comité de logement. Like, each neighborhood usually will have some place who is doing that kind of work. And, of course, we do that work here, and we work with other organizations who are also doing that kind of work. But there's a lot to overcome. There's a lot of changes that need to happen and a lot of things to be fighting against right now.
So what would some of the changes be, like simple ones that...
Well, I mean,
the City
some
of Montreal
of them are,
or the government of Quebec could just implement right
well,
away.
Well, I mean, they could make the tribunal more accessible. They can start welcoming people inside again and not make you make an appointment in order to open your case. They could stop trying to force people to open their cases online. They can prioritize, certain kinds of cases that put tenants in jeopardy. And they can try to help them open their files. There are legislative changes that would also be very, very helpful. Like if they eliminated the ability of a landlord to evict a tenant because they want to change the apartment. Like it's 1959 of the Code Civil. If they eliminated that, so landlords couldn't fail to renew someone's lease because they want to subdivide or change the destination or whatever. That's something we've been working on trying to get them to do. There are a lot of rules for non-payment cases that, like, usually, you know, sometimes there's a legitimate difference of opinion about how much the rent is. Sometimes a tenant, like a landlord, thinks they've increased the rent, and a tenant says, but I've refused your rent increase. And then, you know, and so then they go and they have a hearing, and if the tenant, like, let's say the judge decides the tenant is wrong and the rent really did go up and they owe more rent, they should be given an opportunity to pay that rent and avoid eviction, but instead they're not. They're immediately evicted. Like, right. Like you, if you pay after the judgment, you don't get to keep your apartment.
But
basically,
why would that be? I mean, if you think that you...
Why would that be? That's a good question. But, like, I don't think there's a good answer to that. Mm-hmm. It's like... It doesn't. It's wrong. It doesn't make sense. Once the decision has been rendered, the person who is wrong should now have the opportunity to correct the situation. I mean, even in New York, where I'm from, where, you know, there are some pretty bad things happening, like, a tenant does have an opportunity to pay once the non-payment decision has been rendered, because there are legitimate issues that need to be determined, and you shouldn't have to pay in advance just in case you're wrong.
Exactly.
You know, so that would be a change that needs to be made too, and. Yeah, I mean, rent control, you know, that's another thing some organizations have been fighting, to create a real rent control system in Quebec, which we don't really have. We have a system where people can refuse their rent increases, and then some kind of, you know, system happens where it's calculated. But there should really be true rent control, where there's only a certain amount, a certain percentage that a landlord is allowed to raise the rent. And this would also actually ease some of the congestion in the tribunal, because instead of each individual case needing to be litigated one by one, you would have just one number and it applies to everyone, and you know, and obviously it would need to be a fair number that was based on, you know, the real situation here of like people's economic situations and costs and so on and so forth. But that would be another thing that would be really good, and these things have very, very serious impacts. These housing problems. I mean, I wanted to mention that one of the things that's so difficult for you know, senior citizens who are faced with this sort of issue, and as you said, single women who don't have someone to fall back upon to help them in such a situation. When you get evicted, when you get displaced, it could create a very serious health crisis, both mental health and physical health. Where it is a real, we've seen many people whose mental health problem has either been extremely exacerbated by an eviction or has been begun because of an eviction, because that kind of like displacement at that point in your age is very, very difficult to deal with. So there need to be more protections.
Yeah, I mean, it's just overwhelming. The very idea of moving is overwhelming when you get to 80, let me tell you.
And especially when there are no affordable apartments out there to even move to.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have the energy or whatever to run around.
And most organizations don't help people find apartments. We don't even do that either. We will refer people to places where they can try to find an apartment, but we're not sitting and accompanying someone and making phone calls and trying to help them find another place. It's not one of the things we do. We do, you know, we do like rights. We tell people what their rights are and we help them access their rights, but we don't do apartment searches. So if the city could provide more resources for people who need to find an apartment, and of course more social housing, I mean, that goes without saying. You know, the social housing waiting list is like 5 years long.
Longer, depending
on your situation. You know, all those things need to be fixed as well.
Yeah, I have a foster daughter that's got 13-year-old twins, mm-hmm. and she's been on that list now for about 12 years.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yes, wow. And there's no sign of anything.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically there aren't a lot of options out there. What
percentage of the revenue are people having to spend for a place? Just a simple place.
Honestly, I don't have statistics. I don't know statistics. I can only tell you from my experience seeing a lot of tenants every day that most people are spending the vast majority of their income on their rent. They should only be spending 25%, maybe 30% of their income on their rent. And what we're seeing is minimum 50%, 60%, 70%. And of course, people who are on welfare, we're seeing close to 100%, because the welfare rates are so low, they don't at all match you know, the housing market. I mean, you can make, if you're getting $700-$800 a month, how are you even affording anything unless you're living with a whole bunch of people and sharing the apartment, you know? So it's a huge, it's like most of your revenue, if you're low income, is going to rent, and there's very little left over. And then people have to, like, here's all my money, and now I'll go to a food bank if I'm lucky, and that's how I'm going to eat. And I can't, the toilet paper, I don't know where I'm getting the money for that, you know? That's the reality for most people in that situation.
And this situation, I'm assuming, will get worse as the global economy gets more and more wobbly, right? Because people are now investing in bricks that before would have never considered buying property, because bricks tend to stay bricks, whereas stocks and shares, of course, are going up and down, down, you see.
Okay,
so I'm
yeah.
sure that you have shelter being used as investment.
Options. For sure. I mean, you know, it's a major, it's something that people invest in. You know, there's naturally a big tension when, for one person, this building is a source of trying to get money, and for another person, it's their home. How do you, like, balance those two interests? They're completely opposed and different from one another, and it's problematic. And when more and more, like, and that's the situation where I'm from in New York, like, the real estate industry is, like, the huge, it's a huge influential, you know, the people who have power are the people who own property. And as Montreal becomes more and more like that, we're going to see more and more pain and suffering, because people have to live. People need homes, and it shouldn't be somebody's way of making tons and tons of money. So, you know, that's extremely problematic. And we're going to be seeing more and more, you know, nasty things happening with landlords as it becomes a way to make really, really big bucks. So then people who aren't scrupulous, and not obviously not all landlords are unscrupulous, but there are enough out there who are going to take advantage of the situation and start doing all kinds of insane things, like we're hearing about situations where landlords are taking apartments, like, and renting them out by the room. You know, so before you might have had, like, this apartment is $800 a month. Now it's like each room is $800 a month.
Here in Montreal?
Yeah, well, people are starting to do things like that because they see how much money people are willing to pay for a place to live. So they're starting to take advantage of that. And people, like, who have the money are willing to pay it, like students, young people. Okay, yeah, I'll live with these, like, eight other people, or people who are poor, and it's like, okay, I could pay less if I just pay for a room. But they're charging huge amounts of money for just, like, a room in an apartment. And, you know, it's not like these things are all, like, either illegal or borderline
illegal. Yes.
And we're going to see more and more of that kind of, you know, nasty stuff like that as the real estate market heats up, unless politicians respond by creating protections for people.
And social housing.
And, of course, social housing, yes.
Well, there seems to be very little social housing in Montreal. I mean, I'm from the UK, you know, where social housing was just a given. It was regular.
Mm-hmm.
It's not now, of course, but
was. No, obviously there's a big shortage of social housing. There's no question about that, yeah.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live, feminist radio from an elderly perspective. We're on the air the second Wednesday of each month, this time slot from 6 until 7. I'm Rosemary Wally, and I can hardly believe that this is the last show of 2022, but it is. Last Saturday, the 10th of December, was International Human Rights Day, marking the 74th anniversary of the adoption of the Charter by the UN Assembly on the 10th of December, 1948. It's a very profound and beautiful piece of legislation, worked on by a committee of jurists headed by Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the wife of the president. It was a totally mammoth task just after the Second World War. One of the principal jurists was a Canadian, John Peters Humphrey, who was from New Brunswick, and he was a McGill professor. The charter sets out a list of rights we have as individuals. Needless to say, they're not always or even often respected. Today, we're going to hear a bit more about the charter with our guest, Diane Johnston. So thank you very much, Diane, for joining us. We're also going to look at how older women contribute to peace in our troubled world. And for that, we're going to be talking to Christine Dandino and Laurel Thompson, I hope, and maybe even Alison Hacker, but they're not with us yet. They're going to help us delve into this. But can we start with the question of human rights, Diane?
Yes, of course. And I would like to emphasize what you have just said in the sense that our rights, and here in particular, I'm talking about our civil rights, they are, as you said, not always and often not respected. So we still have a long way to go. So on the occasion of International Human Rights Day, I'm going to be speaking about the necessity of the defense of the rights of some of the most vulnerable people, the measure of the progress of a society is its treatment of the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So how can a modern developed country such as Canada tolerate, for example, the growing poverty that we have here and the homelessness? With regards to the most vulnerable members of our society, there are those who find themselves without status or with precarious status. And these are people, for example, who have left their countries of origin because of war, because of regime change, violence, and sanctions, which Canada often participates in imposing alongside the US. Or they may have left their countries because of climate change, because they were unable to earn a decent living for themselves and for their families. Here in Quebec, they and their children are deprived of such basic rights, for example, as healthcare, education, and services. Many are forced to work underground because this is the only way that they can eke out a subsistence. They often face abhorrent working conditions and the constant threat of arrest, detention, and deportation. The pandemic itself brought to light the fact that during the confinement of these workers, along with international students, they were forced to place themselves on the front lines as essential workers in hospitals, in seniors' homes, grocery stores, filling the shelves, making deliveries, because they were abandoned by both the Quebec and the federal governments. And although they may have been paid lip service by Premier Legault, for example, when he included them alongside nurses and orderlies and others in speaking about them as our guardian angels, no real recognition of their contribution came for the majority of them. For example, only a few were able to profit from a pathway to permanent residency, simply because the others had not provided direct care to seniors who had contracted COVID. More and more, these migrant workers are openly and bravely denouncing their working and living conditions alongside those working on the ground in their defense. That is the many community and human rights organizations, immigration, labor, and constitutional lawyers, medical professionals, workers' organizations, and many others.
Well, I thought I would talk to you about one of these undocumented workers who was my darling cleaning lady, my Carmen. I'm going to try to do this and not cry. So for 10 years, every second Tuesday, I had this beautiful woman, Carmen, who came to clean my house. She adored cleaning. She was a professional cleaning lady. And it was a question of her mental health. She had a very hard life in Portugal. She had a cousin in Laval who told her there was plenty of work in Canada. So Carmen, filled with excitement, sold everything, took leave of her adult daughter, who was a young adult, and arrived in Montreal just 10 years ago this week. There was a snowstorm, of course. For the first couple of months, she went to work with her cousin. But she soon wanted her independence, and she wanted her own houses to clean. She could see that this was quite lucrative. She knew nothing about immigration, the immigration process. She'd never heard of it. And the cousin hadn't mentioned it. Carmen knew that there was a healthcare here and social security if people lost their jobs. She was honestly eager to pay into the system and enjoy those protections, and was crushed to find herself illegal and undocumented. We went to an immigration lawyer in Côte d'Neige here in Montreal, who suggested applying for legal status on humanitarian grounds, for which Carmen would have had to write down her life story in Portuguese, and it would then be translated, and the process would take approximately 3 years. Now, Carmen had had a very hard life, a very violent life, was an intensely personal, private person, and was not about to divulge her life story to the Canadian immigration. She just couldn't do it. Instead, with very limited language skills, but with tremendous courage and warmth, the lovely Carmen set about building a cleaning business for herself. She used to say that her bus pass, it was a bus pass, made her feel human because she was like everybody else. I signed the lease for her, and she was just another immigrant. And looking at her, you'd have seen a woman on her way to and from work. She lived in her own apartment. The daily routine was hard, but the thing that really scared her and that she hated was being illegal. There's this humiliation now that we never even think about. You can't open a bank account. You can't have a credit card. You can't enroll in any kind of language courses that the government offers. It took a tremendous toll on Carmen. And then there were health issues. She fell going into the metro, Villa Maria Metro. I told her to wear different boots, but she wouldn't listen. Anyway, she broke her wrist. Another time, she had a terrible abscess in her mouth and needed dental care. But nothing prepared any of us for the pandemic, and certainly for thousands upon thousands of undocumented people, as you say, Diane, it was catastrophic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Carmen lost her work and depended upon her patrons for money. She was too scared to get vaccinated, even though I kept telling her it was going to be okay. She never complained. She thought of herself as strong, and somehow she never caught the virus. But sadly, 18 months ago, her luck ran out. She discovered a lump on her right breast. With no health care, no card to submit, she was stuck. She knew right away it was cancer because her body felt different. Gradually, the cancer spread to her lungs and she had to stop working. She just made it back to Lisbon in time and in a clean bed, well taken care of, with morphine for the pain. She died after 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
She was only 57.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry about my
No. It's fine. There are very many tragic stories, and very often people are forced to leave their countries because of violence, etc. Yeah. I'd like to give you one example of a situation here in Montreal. In July of 2020, for example, there was an application for a class action lawsuit that was filed at Quebec Superior Court against the Quebec government for having tolerated the illegal refusal to provide medical service free of charge to undocumented migrants and those with precarious status, their children, even though those children were born in Canada. So no medical services for children born here who are in fact Canadian citizens. Okay. And on top of that, to get medical services, these parents who are already in dire straits financially, they were being charged very knowingly by the Quebec government, 200% charge. So twice as much as they should have been charged. The case was finally won. Many professionals, lawyers, community workers, all kinds of doctors, nurses spoke in favor of these people and in defense of their rights. And the case was finally won. We can also speak here, for example, about the situation whereby there are agreements between Quebec and the federal government, where asylum seekers are detained in Quebec prisons, in a detention center such as in Laval, but also in Quebec prisons. And they're given no idea about when they're going to be released. And very often, those who are imprisoned, they are the ones that have mental health issues or problems. An agent simply decides that they may not show up at their hearing. And on those grounds, they're charged like criminals. There are very many things that must be changed. At the same time, Quebec is in need of a workforce, and many of these migrants have been here for years, and they're fully integrated into Quebec life and in culture. And there is a very determined fight going on right now. And this movement is expanding for a regularization program for these people so that they are provided finally with permanent residency. And I just want to use this occasion to encourage everybody to join this fight so that their rights as human beings are finally provided with a guarantee.
If we wanted to join this fight, Diane, how would we do that?
You can follow what is taking place in the sense of following the news. We have publications where we are constantly writing about these issues, informing people about events that are taking place and different fights that are going on so that people are aware. We have the website of the Marxist-Leninist Party, cpcml.ca. There's the Marxist-Leninist Party of Quebec. We have a Facebook page. It's pmlq.qc.ca. Not only are we writing about these issues, but we are also regularly holding meetings and Zooms to discuss the situation of the human rights of all within our society and how to bring those issues forward, how to move them forward.
Well, thank you very much. It's been so informative, Diane. Let's stop now and hear our first piece of music, which is for my darling Carmen. She adored Celine Dion. And as we all know, Celine, dear Celine, at the moment she's very sick. So I think a lot of us in Quebec are thinking of Celine Dion. Mm-hmm. So the song, of course, is My Heart Will Go On. Okay, so let's move on to our second topic. We're going to talk about the role of older women in the peace movement. What is our role? And we'd like to introduce and thank Christine Dandeno for being here with us, and Christine is also a comrade from the Marxist-Leninist Party, as well as Laurel Thompson, who is a writer and professor and has lived in the States for a long time, and has now been in Montreal for a few years, and has worked a lot on transport issues, and is now doing peace stuff.
Well, I will speak as a person that is part of the society in Quebec and in Canada. Yeah. And that the issue of war and peace is a very important preoccupation for everybody. More specifically, because the involvement of the Canadian government and Quebec government, U.S. war machine for domination around the world. The movement of the peace movement or anti-war movement is very active since a lot of years because Quebec and Canadian people don't accept that Canada have an aggressive role or a pro-war role around the world with other countries. Yes. To this issue of the day to date, December 10th of the human rights.
Yeah,
I think that as you said, this day was declared in 1948. It was a very few years after the Second World War. And this declaration was to affirm the human right of the people. And this issue of the fight for security, for respect of right for have a place to live, to eat, to be educated, to participate in society is still a big battle on those days, because this situation is still a big issue, because this right, the human right, are negated in so many ways in the society. But still, this is the fight. I talk about that because it's part of the fight for peace. That's a human right, to be able to live in society that serves the well-being of the people, and war is opposed to that. Starting point is that when we speak about right, is that it belongs to you as a human being. It's not an issue of privilege or possibility. It has to be affirmed. And that's the fight people are waging, to affirm those rights. So to be a human in society that can participate and have food, education, and everything, to be a human. Because if you are not able to enjoy that, how can you be a human? So that's the way it's put today. And to go back to this issue of war, women are at the first range.
At the forefront.
The forefront of the fight for peace and against war here in Canada and Quebec and around the world, because we can see they are the most, part of the most vulnerable, and they are affected by it in so many ways. And for me, in Quebec and Canada, the way it has to be looked at is that what kind of Canada we want. What kind of Canada we want? We don't want a Canada pro-war. We don't want our country to be involved in aggression that the U.S. is making around the world for their domination. In that way, Canada and Quebec is participating very actively on those days in the war machine and interest of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And what you propose me to talk about in order to inform people who listen to the radio show is about actually the role of the Quebec government that we have set for Quebec economy, being part of the processing critical minerals in the Bécancour region.
Yes, this is very interesting, because I think that people don't know about this, especially in the Anglophone world.
Yes.
I think many people don't know where Bécancour is. I do cycle there, but it's on the St. Lawrence River, isn't it? Like in the middle.
Yes. Bécancour is on the St. Lawrence River, is central Quebec, provides world-class industrial and port infrastructure to support the establishment of heavy industry. Targeted by Legault government as essential infrastructure for the further integration of Quebec into U.S. economy and war machine.
That's very scary.
It is. The U.S. government is making no secret on the fact that it is working to secure a made-in-America supply chain for critical minerals, including rare earth elements like lithium, cobalt, nickel, graphite, which, among others, are needed to ensure the U.S. War machine. No number of declarations that the aim is beneficial to the people of Quebec and Canada by ensuring green energy transition. That's the way it is presented. Very nice, very innocent. But it's a key example of this transition, that infrastructure that is being built serves the war machine of the U.S. striving for world domination. Because all this production is very needed. Like we talked about critical mineral needed. Let me give you good example. Missile, portable equipment that soldier carry, and all many things like that. And so part of the, you can say, international situation that Canada, part of the US plan is to get rid of China, or to make problem with China. They need to develop our own economy to respond to their request. So I think that is very important to inform people about that.
Laurel, do you have stuff to add to this?
Canada is the second biggest country in the world. And just the way the United States wants to get control over Russia's resources, I would think they would want to get control over our resources too. And so this plan to secure those critical minerals for the green transition does not surprise me. Does not surprise me. It's very frightening because we're going to lose even more control over what we've got.
It's presented as if it's for the green transition, but it's mainly for military purposes at the same time. So that's what's so dangerous about it, as Christine was explaining, you know, like it really is for the U.S. war machine.
Recent developments have highlighted the aggressive military aims that are behind the building of these plants and infrastructure. Major emphasis is being placed on having Canada break its relation with China so that the U.S. military can take over various mining deposits in Canada through public funding recently announced by the Biden government. Public funds in the U.S. were given to the military, and now the military is using them to help U.S. companies taking over various mining initiatives in Canada and to place Canada and its resource, territories, and workers under their control. This is all done in the name of national security and countering Chinese influence on Canada. And people of Quebec and Canada are kept in the dark or presented as a fait accompli. At the beginning of November, the Canadian government ordered three Chinese firms to divest from a trio of Canadian-based mining company under the oaks of safeguarding Canada's national security. These are attempts led by the intelligence agency to wipe up hysteria against China in order to establish uncontested U.S. control over Canada's critical mineral and supply chain through infrastructures such as port, highway, railway. And Quebec Prime Minister François Legault's energy transition involved with what his government called a global battery cluster in the industrial and port area of Bécancour. So it's a very huge plant, very huge plant, and a lot of company like in Brazilian mining oligopol Vale announced plans to set up in Bécancour. The plant will process annually 25,000 ton of nickel sulfate into nickel sulfate, the chemical compound used in the production of nickel-based lithium-ion battery. And this nickel will come from Vale mining operation in Voisin Bay, Labrador, or Sudbury, Ontario. And Vale and General Motors announced that they have signed a deal to supply nickel from a proposed Vale plant in Bécancour. The other aspect that interests those companies is that they are dealing to have a very low price for electricity. And yes. Everybody knows about what kind of secret deal Quebec government made with critical company so that they have a very low price for using the electricity in Quebec. And that's the interest also of those companies to come here because they will have a lot of help in that way.
Yeah.
There's another company called Nouveau Monde Graphite that are developing graphite 120 kilometers north of Montreal. It's an open pit mine. And also the mining project was approved by the Quebec government with all the environmental studies requests by the Bureau d'Audience Publique sur l'Environnement having been completed. The owner of the company include a British group called Paling Earth and Investissement Québec. They have been joined by a Japanese company and which announced on October 20 that they were investing $25 million and the contribution of Investissement Québec with Palington of $12.5 million. Anyway, huge amount of money are put at the services of those companies to develop that type of industry to serve the purpose of the U.S.
Yeah.
And the way it's presented publicly is that it's for energy transition, green energy transition. So that's when we heard about this big declaration, like today with the COP15, big declaration that they want to protect biodiversity and they want to have green transition, if it's very important, it's the purpose, the real purpose of it. How can someone be not for green transition? It's for if it is to protect, but the fact that it is used for war machines that destroy the society and biodiversity, a big destructor. To be very vigilant about those declarations. The main thing is that there's a big transition about that focus in Canada today, how to develop that industry, integration of the US economy and war machine. And as I say, the Biden government facilitate that with the money given to the military to help those companies in Canada and Quebec. Other thing I want to say also, because it's very important, if I can, let me see my note. Oh yeah, like for other example of that interest, Blinken, when he came here with and visit with Mélanie Joly, you know, they were at Metro Jean Talon and blah, blah, blah with a parade. The fact is that he visited Canada during October 27-28 visit to Canada, aim at telling Canada to fall in line with the US attempt to further isolate China and Russia and further integrate Canada into the US war machine, Blinken, Secretary of State, along with Foreign Minister Mélanie Joly, visited a pilot plant in Montreal for recycling lithium-ion battery for electric vehicle. The pilot plant is called Recyclage Lithium. It's jointly owned by foreign private interest General Motors and a South Korean company and Canadian and Quebec government. And Legault invested $15 million in equity in Recyclage Lithium and provided $7.5 million in subsidies to this company. Different activities are done in that way to develop all this infrastructure, because they need that infrastructure. The US interests and Canada have no problem with that. And as you said, Laurel, in that all this situation, there is no indication that Legault government will be able to control where these processes in their role will end up, because they don't have any control. Who decide, you know? Like, no. In other words, the supply chain and critical mineral that begin with their extraction and then their processing is not under the control of the Legault government, but rather Anglo-American, Brazilian, European, Japanese, and private interests that compete with China and Russia. Legault never called that way, but the facts are the facts.
And Legault welcomes this investment because it creates jobs and it's good for the Quebec economy. And so he can be seen to be improving life for Quebecers. And if they don't investigate too deeply, they don't realize what it is that they're giving away.
In fact, yes.
And he's very good at that. I'm going to an event tomorrow in Merci Hochelaga at the Marché Maisonneuve. There's a protest against the Raymond Logistics.
Oh, yeah, tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow at the Marché Maisonneuve. And that's a group of citizens who are protesting against turning that industrial area into a container ship trucking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, you know, right now the St. Lawrence is only 35 feet deep. And that would not be deep enough for container ships. Does Legault have plans to dig deeper into the St. Lawrence
that's a good question.
Container ships can come up all the way to Montreal, unload, and then put the products on this land at Raymond Logistics near Viao, a metro station,
mm-hmm.
and then truck them elsewhere. I'm not sure, but that's probably part of his larger plan. If this is indeed what you're saying, you know?
Yes, it's a good point, because it's huge, huge territories that are used for those containers, huge.
And the residents who live nearby are absolutely right to be concerned, because it's going to destroy it as a place to live, where they live. It's going to be noisy, going to be polluted. They won't be happy there once that starts. There's a march happening tomorrow, 1 o'clock at the Marché Maisonneuve. This is the thing we're up against. The globalization of the world economy has been so damaging to our authority over what happens where we live. And now we're coming up against some terrible problems with that. And finally, I think we have a turn of events that is pushing back against globalization. And I hope that it's going to lead to our taking more control over our economy than we have now.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African current affairs and analysis brought to you here at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. Doug and I are sitting in our virtual studios, not quite back in person, but hoping to do so in the next couple of months. Doug, you and I had an opportunity to make a connection with an organization called Dawn, and you have a personal connection with this feminist organization. They chatted with us, and that's what we'll be presenting tonight. Could you just give us a few details on who they are?
Well, yes. Sue Gott may be familiar. The name should be familiar to our listeners now, having been part of our broadcasts around the book launch around the International Brigades Against Apartheid. She was one of the ANC operatives operating out, working out of Zimbabwe in the late 80s and up into the early 90s, and has lived in South Africa till just two or three years ago, where she's bought a home in Canada and returning part-time doing the snowbird thing the rest of the year in South